Hi, this is Pod Save the UK. I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Khan. Keir Starmer is having a busy week as he tries to keep Trump from totally losing it over Greenland, as well as his new obsession, the Chagos Islands.
It would be nice for the UK's Prime Minister to have a bit of time to actually run the UK. So is the government's new Warm Homes Plan the kind of policy to help Labour tackle the rise of reform? Nigel Farage is collecting disaffected Tory figures like Trump collects other people's peace prizes. Liam Thorpe from the Liverpool Echo will give us his insights.
Plus, Palestinian comedian Alaa Shahada is with us to discuss his latest project, which shows the reality of trying to do a comedy tour in an occupied state.
And of course, we'll be dealing with all the news about Brand Beckham.
Yes, all of life is truly here.
This is expressly against my wishes. Donald Trump rolls into the elite money club of Davos today, having had, even by his standards, an insane week. We have no idea what's going to come out of his mouth. Here he is addressing world leaders. So bear in mind, this is happening after we're recording. So I literally have no idea what the fuck I'm teeing up here.
We probably won't get anything unless I decide to use excessive strength and force, where we would be, frankly, unstoppable. But I won't do that. All the United States is asking for is a place called Greenland.
Now, a leaked letter revealed that he is blaming his threats to take total control of Greenland on the Norwegian government's decision to give the Nobel Peace Prize to someone other than him. A letter, which is full of the usual Trump inaccuracies bullshit, shows the leader of the free world has the self-control of a toddler who's got into the jammy dodgers once more.
He's managed to get it wrong, not once, but twice, because not only is that an unfathomable excuse for threatening to invade a country, it's also an independent committee that decides where to award the prize, not the Norwegian Prime Minister.
Normally, when someone is that wrong, it doesn't really matter. You can kind of ignore it. But Trump's inability to understand basic facts is impacting us every day. Keir Starmer had to start the week dealing with the threat of massive tariffs on the UK and EU after a different Trump tantrum.
Listen, we are very repeatedly critical of Keir Starmer's leadership of the Labour Party and this country. The only time where I feel he's completely powerless to manage what's going on in front of him is when Donald Trump becomes involved. What I would say is that as soon as Trump came into office, he had started saber-rattling about Greenland. So maybe actually we shouldn't have been as caught cold by this as we have been. Sky News' Mark Stone has reported that in a weekend call, Starmer managed to get Trump to calm down a little and admit that he might have been misinformed and jumped to the tariff threats too quickly. Now, obviously that's an interesting development. Doesn't seem to have translated into any public pronouncements.
No.
Trump continues to saber-rattle about tariffs on European countries that have sent troops into Greenland. There is this strange thing that Starmer said on Monday, where he said that, you know, as part of his reasoning for not threatening retaliatory tariffs, he said that this thing needs to be done in a kind of reasonable grown-up way. But that's not taking into account who he's trying to negotiate with. You're not dealing with a reasonable person. It's like trying to explain string theory to a toddler. Like, it's unfathomable what he's trying to do. I keep reading op-ed pieces written by, I think, you know, well-intentioned journalists that are, you know, asking questions like, is this the end of the rules-based international order? What the fuck are you talking about? Rules-based international order? It's like somebody trying to give etiquette lessons to a man who's currently dunking his balls in the soup. It doesn't make any sense. Or it just feels like there is a total fundamental disconnect between everything that Donald Trump is saying and the high-minded questions being asked by people who write op-eds and, to be honest, a lot of the front bench of the Labour Party at the moment.
I listened to an interview with Darren Jones yesterday, and he was actually trying to talk about something else. But, you know, as is the case, just Donald Trump just takes over every single conversation when we want to talk about the news of the day. And he was trying to say, look, actually, Britain's really good at diplomacy. We're doing diplomacy behind closed doors. That's what they keep saying. It's really hard to have confidence in that, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, that feels a little bit like, do you remember when Labour came to power, where they were like, we won't tell you what we're going to do, but we are going to do some cool things. Just trust us. This whole, like, just trust us thing, it's just not working. I've become very, very frustrated with it. I do want to mention mention, though, that Nigel Farage is missing Prime Minister's questions to possibly hang out with his MAGA friends at Davos, despite criticising the meeting of these financial elites for years. Funny that, Nigel Farage. He's always like, oh, these elites, they do things. But then as soon as he is invited, what is he doing? Richard Tice says it's a chance for Farage to speak to Trump about the tariff threat in Greenland. I guess we'll really see how close they actually are.
He's repeatedly criticised Davos as a meeting of globalist elites or whatever. Insert phrase he's got from some bot on Twitter here. But he's there right now. And Nigel Farage has always been, you know, an insider within the establishment who's managed to sell himself as an insurgent. And in that way, he is very Trumpian. You know, Trump is a sort of property dauphin from the kind of New York elite who has sort of, again, sold himself as a kind of champion of the working man. It's unsurprising that Trump and Farage have found themselves as kind of political bedfellows because there is so much alignment in the way that they present themselves publicly. Richard Tice has talked up the idea that Farage might have Trump's ear in these particular conversations. I think any time I hear somebody say that they have a kind of ear with Trump or they have a Trump whisperer thing, I always think you're about to get sold some fucking magic beans. Like, you're naive beyond belief. And, you know, we talked to Tommy Vietor on this show a couple of weeks ago, and he said that there are a lot of leaders like Claudia Sheinbaum from Mexico and Mark Carney in Canada who are getting results often by standing up to Trump. And they're getting results in terms of pushback, but also they are, you know, seeing domestic bumps at home in polling data. I think that the line Starmer is trying to draw is possibly politically inadvisable, but also it's perilously naive to think that you can reason with Donald Trump. And people keep refusing to take the things that he's saying at face value. You know, we kept being told he's not going to invade Venezuela. Look at where we are now. He has been talking about Greenland for almost the entirety of the last 12, 13 months. When he says things like, we will have to take it or we will have to do it however we have to do it, we should probably start taking him at face value. And the next phase of conversation has to be, what happens if US troops land in Greenland? You know, Emmanuel Macron has called the tariffs unacceptable. He's actually at Davos, and we should shout out his incredible choice of sunglasses. He has gone full aviators.
Incredible.
Full Top Gun.
And so they're reflective, and therefore you cannot see his eyes, which apparently is the intended point. He has a non-serious eye condition. He was red and puffy. He didn't want people talking about that. Rather, they wanted him to, you know, people to listen to what he was saying. But I think this is a lesson for all of us who are nightlife lovers. who among us has not worn sunglasses on the first tube home? Reflective. Add that extra bit, guys. Reflective.
Legally, we can make no pronouncements about what Emmanuel Macron may have been doing the night before he had to give the speech. But aviators are quite a good way of covering up your eyes if you've hit the claret a bit too hard. Listen, the row has got very strange in the last few days. Trump called the British decision to return the Chagos Islands back to Mauritius an act of, and this was in a Truth Social post, so it was in all caps, great stupidity. And, you know, let's face it, he is the expert in great stupidity. But it was less than a year ago that he, as US president, backed the deal during Starmer's trip to Washington. So he's decided to have a complete U-turn on this. So the UK has controlled the Chagos Islands since 1965, when the UK purchased the islands from Mauritius.
So the Chagossians have been split over this new deal, under which the UK will lease the islands from Mauritius through a 99-year arrangement while also keeping control of the US-UK military base on Diego Garcia. So that's the largest of the islands. Mauritius's Attorney General has responded to Trump's criticism, stressing that it still expects the deal to go ahead and that it should no longer be subject to debate. That it has really been agreed. The US backed the deal when it was signed. The US Secretary of State said Trump had expressed his support for the monumental achievement and said the deal reflects the enduring strength of the US-UK relationship.
Critics of the deal say it potentially opens up the region to China's fishing fleet, which the country uses to gather intelligence. The deal is in its final stages of making its way through Parliament. Trump's criticism of the deal has been jumped on by Kemi Badenoch and figures within the Reform Party who were critical of it to begin with. Again, it sometimes feels like we're wasting our time when we point out that Trump has been hypocritical because it sort of suggests that we've set a standard that he has shown no interest in meeting whatsoever. You know, I remember in the kind of 2000s, there was a real vogue of trying to point out when politicians were being hypocritical. Trump lies moment to moment.
Yeah, yeah.
So it does feel a bit redundant to say, well, actually, I think you'll find you said that you were in favour of this. He doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
He will literally say whatever is going through his head at that moment. He has no problem in contradicting himself. I mean, I think that there is a really serious conversation to be had about how the kind of international community reshapes itself around a US presidency that has no interest in engaging directly with it and is, in certain instances, going to be a hostile actor in those kind of international conversations. And organizations like the European Union, a country like ours, needs to start having conversations about what this looks like. We're just a year into this presidency. There are still three more to go, maybe more. We currently don't know. Again, if we're operating on a policy that we believe things when they're said directly to us, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, Steve Bannon was talking about Trump third term. This is not a problem that we can just sort of wish away. We need to have difficult conversations, I think.
Yeah, I think it's also worth mentioning that he's using what he has now decided is this Chagos deal, which is stupid, as another one of his reasons for why they must own Greenland. I'm using that word own. Because apparently they're saying, this is, you know, you can't trust the UK. They make terrible decisions. Look what they're doing. And that is also why we need Greenland, because only the US can actually make these sound decisions. I mean, it must be so... I can't imagine how scary it is having to deal with this man that you have no idea what he's going to do. And then have that realization. It's not only what he's going to do, but also what he's done, and all of that being reneged on.
Yeah,
that is obviously very instable and very, it must be really hard to work with. But at the same time, everyone's facing it. There's surely more that can be done by collaborating with our European people. Also struggling basically with him.
My friends in the States. That is the kind of exhaustion of it, because they just, every single day, they don't know what he's going to do, what he's going to do next. You know, there are ICE agents running around US cities. These are people armed with very little training in some instances. That, I think, you know, it is really exhausting. And if you want to hear a sane American perspective on the Trump tariffs, head over to our sister pod, Pod Save America, where John and Tommy will take you through them. Now, thankfully, Keir Starmer has managed to get one potential win on the board this week with the long-awaited Warm Homes Plan, which will release £15 billion of funding to upgrade homes in England.
The plan includes specific help for those on low incomes, protections for renters, and the government hopes it will lift up to 1 million people out of fuel poverty. There's also a separate £1.5 billion fund for devolved administrations in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland.
To talk about this and a couple of other key issues, we're delighted to be joined by Liam Thorpe, the political editor of the Liverpool Echo. Liam, welcome to Pod Save the UK.
Thanks very much for having me. It's an honour and a privilege.
That is a huge claim, Liam.
I mean it.
I don't think anyone's ever been honoured to be in my presence before, whether in real life or on Zoom.
But Nish, ever since I saw you attempting to be a local journalist, I've been inspired.
I'm a huge inspiration to local journalists everywhere. Liam is referring to a show called Hold the Front Page, which is available on Sky TV and Now TV, where me and Josh Widdicombe attempted to be local journalists. And I think it's fair to say, showed how difficult the job of journalism really is.
Everyone tells us that they could do this job better than us, and I think you proved that that's not true.
Yeah, I think that was sort of the aim of it, because Josh actually did a qualification in journalism, and I think he was sort of trying to make a kind of satirical point about how you could learn all the theory, but it's very different in practice.
So, Liam, let's talk about this Warm Homes Plan. What stands out for you?
You know, this has been, I think most people would have to say, a government of disappointments so far. I think anyone who was hoping to see real radical change from the Labour Party has been met with not that, and a lot of screeching U-turns and frustrations, really. So on something like this, and obviously we're just getting the detail this morning, so I will need to see more and more of it, but it feels positive that there is some big decisions being made on this and some big numbers behind them. So, you know, £15 billion over 5 years is not to be sniffed at. We all know that this kind of issue, these green issues need to be tackled. Well, we don't all know that. Most reform-led councils don't believe in it at all. But I think what this is doing is it's putting the green agenda, it's combining it with the cost of living agenda. And if you ask anyone in any part of the country, really, what the big issue is, I think cost of living is the top one. And if I was advising the Labour government, I'd tell them to stop talking so much about immigration and to talk about the cost of living, because that is still the biggest impact. We've just seen today inflation going up. We know, and certainly in regions like the one I cover here in Merseyside, many, many people are in different kinds of poverty, including fuel poverty, which will obviously be attempted to be dealt with here. And when I speak to people about the green stuff, about, you know, obviously trying to help with climate change, a lot of people say, well, you know, that's not really something I can focus on at the moment. I've got to put food on the table. And what this is doing is saying that, yes, by helping with the climate agenda, we can actually also help with your energy bills, with your, you know, coming out of fuel poverty, with making your life easier. And I think it's been a long time coming. And I think that's really important. And if you look at the reaction from the sector today, from energy and from finance, it's been largely welcomed. Don't get me wrong, it doesn't always go far enough. You know, there will be some people that will be sad to see that there's no plan to phase out gas boilers and really kind of wean ourselves fully off fossil fuels. But I think helping people to install, you know, whether it's heat pumps or solar panels that will actually help their bills, and selling it as a saving for them rather than a sort of altruistic move for the planet, is the way to go, really, because people are still really suffering.
It's also been welcomed by Generation Rent, the campaign group for renters' rights. This is their response. It's important for both renters and the climate that the government is raising the basic insulation and heating standards for rented homes. We look forward to working with the department on giving renters who are eligible for support to improve their home the assurances they need to apply for it. Liam, 1.6 million children live in private accommodation and are suffering from cold, damp or mould. Is there an argument that this £15 billion is not going to be enough to deal with that eye-wateringly large number?
It's really sad to say, but there's barely a day goes past in this job as a regional journalist that we don't have someone coming to us in a desperate situation, living in a rented property, mould dripping through the ceiling, cold, often with children, and they really feel like they have nowhere to turn. There's very little in terms of council housing in the country, so people are forced into the private sector. And, you know, unfortunately, there are many landlords who don't obey their responsibilities. Many do, but plenty of the ones that we come across don't. And people just don't really feel like they have any say in it. So at least including them in this plan, in making sure it's not just for people who are homeowners, it's for renters as well, who have a right to live, they're just as much right as anyone else to live in warm, safe homes, I think is a start. But as you say, Nish, it's obviously not going to tackle or address that massive, massive systemic issue that we have as part of our widespread housing crisis in this country. But it's good to see renters involved.
After the break, we'll ask if Reform are just becoming the Conservative Party, and we'll also be asking why the government has put the Hillsborough Law on hold with Liam.
If you missed some of your favorite Crooked Pods this week, don't worry. You can now catch up on the week's best moments on MS Now on Saturday nights. MS Now is streaming an episode of highlights from your favorite Crooked Pods, packing as much analysis, funny moments, and 100% correct opinions into 40 minutes as humanly possible. Crooked on MS Now airs every Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific.
Next up, let's talk about Reform. So the Reform Defection Party, which let's call it that for now, apparently has come to an end. They had trailed a move by a Labour figure. They were really banging on about it. We're going to get a big name from the Labour Party. It failed to happen.
Yeah, Nigel Farage had been talking it up, but we understand, or certainly the public pronouncements they're making about it currently are, that it's been delayed until further notice while the party focuses on the threats from Trump to impose tariffs over Greenland. I mean, again, in terms of the stories we're seeing from across the country, I'm pretty sure a lot of the people living in reform-led councils would rather they were focused on things like bin collection and not increasing council taxes rather than what Trump is doing about Greenland. But anyway, let's not get too far in the weeds with that.
Also, we're delaying it until we can focus on this. Well, I thought you were best friends with Donald Trump, Nigel Farage. Why don't you pick up the phone? Anyway, over the weekend, there was a move by Tory backbencher Andrew Rosendale to the Reform Party who are not really the Conservative Party they promise. So is this more evidence of surging support for reform, or is the party just becoming a target for, to use what a Liberal Democrat source said, a career politician worried about getting a P45?
Liam, what do you make of this sort of spate of defections? Obviously, the most high profile so far being Robert Jenrick.
I actually think it's becoming a big problem for Nigel Farage. At one point, you are the insurgent kind of, you know, you're outside of the noise. I mean, I don't agree with this because actually I don't think Nigel Farage is in any way that what he tries to portray himself as and what he quite often successfully does do as being kind of outside of the kind of elite. But that's the image that they want, and that's the image that they're finding successful at the moment in terms of this insurgency into the kind of traditional two-party situation. But if you're just bringing on all the Tories from the last 14 years, from the establishment that you apparently are here to disrupt, then that's a bit of a mixed message, really, isn't it? Because, you know, Robert Jenrick sat there alongside Nigel Farage saying that the Tories broke Britain. And I'm like, it's that Spider-Man meme of pointing at the other Spider-Man. Like, you were literally the guy who was there throughout all of this. And voters aren't stupid. I mean, they're going to start to realise, hold on, are we just re-electing the Tories? A couple of big hitters, a couple of defections probably worked for them. Now it seems like it's the Tories and reform. And I think that will be a problem for Farage, because you can no longer be the sort of the big bolshy outsider when you are just bringing in guys who were in the cabinet, who were ministers, who were serving in the party that was in power for 14 years. That there is no establishment party like the Conservative Party. And if you're filling your ranks with them, then that's a big part of your message, I think, that is weakened by that. I don't know how much further it will go. The thing about reform is they've probably always got to factor in that they're going to lose a few people to suspensions at some point, because that's usually what happens. So they're probably bolstering their numbers on the basis that they're going to lose a few to some sort of scandal along the way as well. But I think this could become a little bit of an issue for them.
I mean, I think two things there. I was in a car that was driving past Dulwich College 3 days ago, and I have to say, which is famously when Nigel Farage went to secondary school, it didn't seem like it wasn't elite. It just from driving past the acreage of Dulwich College's sports field, it didn't seem like it was very far outside the elite. And also, you know, I think we've restated this the last couple of weeks, you know, listening to Nadeem Zahawi's speech, listening to Robert Jenrick's speech about the state of this ravaged country that has been completely destroyed and is on its knees, I would be absolutely livid with the party that has run the country for most of the last decade and a half. If I was in Robert Jenrick and Nadeem Zahawi's position, I'd be trying to find out who was in charge. It's all very, you know, I think you should leave hot dog sketch. Yeah, like, it's all very, we've got to find the guys that did this. I guess the advantage to reform is that they can make the case that they're bringing in people who have experience of government. They have experience of fucking up government, but experience is experience. But is there also a problem that you know, Nigel Farage is the big name. He is the draw of reform. Is there a threat to him that he's bringing in some, certainly in Robert Jenrick, relatively high-profile figures from the British right?
Yes, I think, and I don't think it's as much a threat for him as it is a threat for them, really. Like, I think anyone amongst us will predict that Jenrick and Farage will at some point have a massive fallout and it'll all go horribly wrong. And it'll be obviously delightful to see. And, you know, Robert Jenrick has made really no secret of his ambitions. He is as kind of as brazen about that. I mean, so much to the point of leaving his defection speech on the photocopier, if reports are to be correct. You know, you've got someone there who is very much up for climbing the ladder wherever possible. And now you've got Nigel Farage, as you say, this kind of godfather figure of reform. He's not going to really tolerate any of that, is he? And I predict fireworks along the way. One thing I saw someone tweet the other day was, how many more defections until Ed Davey just randomly by accident becomes the leader of the opposition? Because the Tories' numbers are just wilting and wilting by the day, aren't they? So you could have an accidental change of opposition there. It's worth pointing out that on my home patch here in Merseyside, we've had quite a lot of defections from councillors as well. And as you would imagine, most of this happens from former Tories. So in the Wirral, just off over the water from Liverpool, we had three councillors who were formerly Conservatives who've gone to reform. Don't think people were too surprised by that. However, elsewhere in Merseyside, in St. Helens, we had a councillor who's defected from the Greens to reform,
wow,
which is about as random a political journey that I could ever imagine. I've asked him for an interview to explain to voters who voted him in as a Green Party counsellor to explain why it is that he's now representing Nigel Farage's reform. So far, he's yet to respond.
Forget an interview, Liam. You could write a whole book about somebody defecting from Greens to Reform.
Want to know who hurt you, man. Incredible. Who hurt you? So how far do you think Reform are going to go in the upcoming local elections, based on what you're seeing?
Where the Green to Reform journey was in St. Helens, which is in Merseyside. It's very different from Liverpool, where I am now. It's a post-industrial town. You know, a lot of jobs and industry have gone from that area, and that's the kind of place where we are seeing Reform do well. We have seen them in the last local elections. I expect them to do very well in places like St. Helens this year in May. It's a kind of classic Labour-run town in the Red Wall. Labour have pretty much held the council for most of the time since it was formed in 1974. Having spoke to everyone on the streets there and to council people, I think that Reform will at least be the largest party, if not take full control. And, you know, I'm sure you guys are aware of the kind of the idea of Merseyside, particularly Liverpool, is a, you know, is not somewhere that you would expect generally for right-wing populism to do well. And I think it shows that they are finding inroads into all sorts of areas, mainly because people are disaffected, mainly because people feel a bit left behind. When I was on the streets in St. Helens talking to people, what really kind of surprised me was that there wasn't like massive love for Nigel Farage, but they were so, so fed up of establishment politics. And I have to say, incredibly negative about Keir Starmer and the Labour Party, that they just felt it was time to give someone else a go. And I sort of tried to casually point to them that it's not just giving someone a go. This is an extremely potentially divisive politician that could be quite dangerous for a lot of people living in this country. But this kind of slightly blasé approach of like, we just need to give someone else a go.
There's been so many stories about Nigel Farage and how awful he is. What an awful guy he is. And it does feel like nothing can stick to him. Is that the impression you get as well?
Certainly coming away from that that vox pop with people in St. Helens, I did feel that way. I felt that there were people saying that even though they didn't really like him, they found him a bit unpalatable. And, you know, there was one guy who said he totally believed all the reports and the allegations of racism when he was at school and things like that. But it didn't necessarily change his view that it was worth giving him a try. And I found that quite depressing, really. People don't necessarily like Farage. They believe some of the stuff they're reading about him, but they're so anti this Labour government. And, you know, I've been frustrated with this Labour government. I think most people probably have been. From my perspective, Keir Starmer's quite a sort of bland leader. He doesn't provoke too many strong reactions. But for some people, it's just pure hatred. But they don't seem to feel that in the same way towards someone who is coming in and saying that he's going to cancel, you know, indefinite leave to remain for some people who've lived here for a long time, or disrupt families, you know, all that sort of stuff. I find it quite hard to believe, but I guess that is kind of part of the point of populism. Reform don't have a record to defend. So far, they haven't really had to do much except for, you know, shout from the sidelines. What, you know, my fear is that will carry them into power on a national level, and it'll be too late by the time we start to realise how poorly they will be able to govern. You know, they'll already be there.
Now, on Monday, the government pulled the final debate on the Hillsborough Law. This law, of course, is named after the terrible disaster which occurred nearly 40 years ago. In April 1989, a fatal crowd crush occurred during a FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest. It led to the deaths of 97 fans, and it remains the UK's worst sporting disaster.
Liam, what's behind this delay? What's going on here?
The Hillsborough Law Bill, which, as your listeners may know, is basically designed to force public officials to tell the truth. A lot of people would say, well, why do you need a law to do that? And unfortunately, yeah, There's so many examples in this country, from the post office to the infected blood scandal to Hillsborough to Manchester Arena, where we know that families who have just been unlucky enough to be caught up in something so tragic have faced lies, smears, obfuscation by the state, by public bodies, on their route to try and find the truth and justice. So we know it's needed. Keir Starmer has promised it time and time again to the Hillsborough families here in Liverpool. And it was a really historic day when we got to go into Downing Street for the day that it was first going to be laid before Parliament. However, it then has to make its way through the House of Commons, on through the House of Lords, before it gets royal assent and becomes this historic bill, which we all believe it will be a historic epoch-defining bill, really. It could really, you know, change the way that the country works. The families always said there was going to be hiccups along the way. They believe that there are organs of the state and the establishment that don't really want this change because they've been used to operating on their own terms for so long. And unfortunately, kind of right towards the final stage of the House of Commons, we've hit this big hurdle. And to put it succinctly, it's about the intelligence services, it's about MI5, MI6, GCHQ, and how they will be governed by this duty of candor, the thing that forces you to tell the truth at things like inquests and inquiries. This is particularly sensitive for the families of the Manchester Arena bombing, because we now know that members of the intelligence community did lie about what they knew about the attacker in that situation when they were asked about it. So that's why it's so important. However, from the government side, they say it's really delicate, because if you are a spy and you are being called to an inquiry or an inquest or something like that, they say there can be bits of information that just simply cannot be released because of national security. And so they inserted this amendment, which basically meant that the head of that service would have the discretion to say, on this occasion, that information shouldn't be released. But now, if you're the families, you're thinking, well, we've been lied to so many times before. How can we trust that that head of that service isn't just going to use that power and that amendment to cover their own backsides?
For context, for listeners who might not be fully aware of some of the details of this, the police initially blamed the fans. They fed sort of false stories of drunken hooliganism to the press. There was an infamous Sun front page that alleged that Liverpool fans had, and this is a direct quote, urinated on the brave cops and picked the pockets of victims. A 2012 independent panel found that 164 police statements had been altered. This is direct interference by the state. It's an institutional cover-up. And I think, Liam, I think you're so correct to bracket this with the post office scandal and the infected blood scandal and discuss it as part of a pattern of institutional cover-ups within the British state. Ian Byrne, who's the MP for Liverpool West and has been a long-time campaigner for the law, said, "It's imperative that any legislation leaving the Commons is truly worthy of being called the Hillsborough Law before it proceeds to the Lords." Would you say that that is a sentiment being shared by the families at the moment, that it's not so much an anger that this thing is being delayed as it is a real burning desire from everybody who's been campaigning for it for so long to get it right?
Absolutely. You know, Ian speaks for the families. He is their parliamentary representative. Ian was at Hillsborough. He knows about this more than most people. I'm sure you're aware of Margaret Aspinall, whose 18-year-old son was killed at Hillsborough. This law, unfortunately, won't help the Hillsborough families, because they have tried every avenue now. And whilst they got to the truth through the panel that you mentioned, Nish, and new inquests in 2016, which found that their loved ones were unlawfully killed, they've never really got justice. No one's been held criminally accountable. So they reached the end of their journey on that front. So everything they're doing now is about changing the country for others so that other people don't go through what they went through in their decades long, you know, 30 plus years fight for truth and justice. Because at the end of the day, for them, this will be the ultimate legacy for the family members that they lost and for them in the fight that they've had. But most importantly, they want it to stop other people going through the same thing as they did. And if they can get it over the line, it will be a historic day. I do believe that the Prime Minister wants to get this done. You know, he's promised it several times. He has a relationship with the families. He speaks to them a lot. But ultimately, as far as I'm concerned, if the Hillsborough families support it, then we support it and everyone should.
Because this event happened such a long time ago. I mean, it happened 1989. That's near enough when I was born. You know what I mean? And like, so there's a risk that some of these families might age out and never actually get what they're looking for, which is, I mean, we've seen that across the board. We saw that in Windrush scandal as well. And that seems really horrible. The reason I mention this is because I think if you're not familiar with it, it's important to say that Hillsborough is an open wound for the people in those areas. I know you were saying earlier about people hate Keir Starmer. Presumably, this is not going to help his reputation in these areas.
No, absolutely not. And every time I report that there's been a delay or there's been a difficulty, of course, people immediately blame the Prime Minister. And, you know, Ian Byrne said to me on the phone the other day, well, he's the Prime Minister, he can sort it out. And I guess that is true. But you do also have to look at all these other elements to it. In my opinion, this is trying to get a complete rewiring of how government works over the line. And there are parts of government that are resistant to that, definitely. We've seen it earlier in the process. We've seen it with the Treasury and other parts. And I do think that the Prime Minister has driven quite a lot of this through. This definitely is the biggest stumbling block so far, because he's obviously been being very much spoken to quite seriously by the intelligence community about national security. The families reject that, by the way. They say that this bill will actually strengthen national security. It won't affect it. But yeah, you're right about the open wound. I mean, you only have to come to Liverpool and you will see everywhere that people are still deeply traumatized and deeply moved by Hillsborough. The Sun newspaper, for example, is boycotted in the city. Nowhere sells it. because of that front page that you mentioned, that flags at Anfield every single week, which would pay tribute to Hillsborough victims and their families. And as you say, really important to say, across the board, it's called a Hillsborough Law, but it is affecting so many people. There's a massive group, a massive campaign group, from the nuclear test veterans to Windrush to Grenfell to, as we've mentioned before, the post office and the infected blood, so many different groups. And unfortunately, that is a damning indictment of this country and how it treats people. So this can be the ultimate change to that, but it has to be right. And I just really, really hope that the government listens and comes back with a proper amendment that the families can support.
You're an experienced journalist. You've written about a huge number of stories over the years. And, you know, especially on the political side of things, there's so much weekly churn. But with this, you've been talking directly to families affected by tragedy, families who, like you say, members of whose families went to a football match and never came home. What is it like to follow a story like this so intimately for so many years and be hearing directly from the people most affected by it?
Yeah, it's really emotional, to be honest. There's a thing with journalism where you have to kind of create a bit of an epistemic distance sometimes between you and what you write about, because if we got upset about everything we write about, we wouldn't be able to do it. You have to develop quite a thick skin. But on Hillsborough, it's right up there with the most important things that I have ever covered. Hillsborough has such an important part in this city's makeup and its fabric. We've been covering Hillsborough since 1989. We had, you know, reporters there. And the Echo was always championed the side of the families, and always will do. So whatever happens, we'll be on their side. 1989, it's such a long time ago, and they are still today having their lives completely dominated by this. They are drained. They are emotional. They are up and down. Of course, you would be. Every time that this comes back into the news, it reminds them of the trauma that they've been through. But ultimately, I'm just staggered by their bravery and their strength to keep going, you know, so many years later, to keep taking the fight to the heart of government. These are ordinary Scousers, just ordinary people, mainly working class people whose family went to, as we say, went to a football match and didn't come home. They never asked to be brought into this situation. They never asked to have to sort of come together with all these people that they don't know and be sort of bounded for life. Because they just all were unfortunate enough to be put in such a tragic situation. So for them to just keep going, well, the least we can do is keep backing them. And it's a privilege to do that.
Liam, thank you so much for joining us on Pod Save the UK. After the break, Trump's putting together a gruesome board of, inverted commas, peace for Gaza, with not one Palestinian involved. We speak to Palestinian comedian Ala Shahada. Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Shopify.
When you're young, you dream of being anything, astronaut, president, or a king or queen. As you get older, your dreams change, focusing less on running the world and more about how you can take your skills and ideas and turn them into something real. Instead of dreaming of going to space or owning your own castle, maybe start dreaming of owning your own business. You'll need a website, a payment system, a logo, and a way to advertise to new customers. It can be overwhelming, it can be confusing, but thankfully, this is where today's sponsor, Shopify, comes in.
Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to brands just getting started.
What if I can't design a website? Shopify's got you from the get-go with beautiful, ready-to-go templates to match your brand style.
What if I need a hand? Get help with everyday tasks like enhancing product images, writing product descriptions, or generating discount codes with Shopify's AI tools created for commerce.
What if people haven't heard about my brand? Shopify helps you find your customers with easy-to-run email and social media campaigns.
And what if I get stuck? Well, Shopify's always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support.
Turn those dreams into and give them the best shot at success with Shopify.
Sign up for your £1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
Go to shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk. This week, the US president has announced his so-called Board of Peace, which is set to run Gaza. As we record this, I understand that Politico are reporting that Netanyahu has agreed to be on this board, so it's sounding a bit more like a board of occupation. Membership, nonetheless, does not come cheap. He's asked countries to cough up a whopping $1 billion for a permanent spot.
There's not a single seat reserved for a Palestinian, and the charter does not mention Gaza, sparking speculation that this is an attempt to build an alternative to the UN. Tess Ingram has just returned from 4 months deployment in Gaza. She's from UNICEF. And here's what she had to say about the current conditions inside the occupied territory.
I want you to imagine for a second that you're Nesrine, a mother I met just a few weeks ago in the Gaza Strip. Your five children are with you, crying, wet. Their feet are caked in mud. They have no shoes. Your husband was killed a few months ago in a strike, and you're 7 months pregnant, alone, trying to figure out what to do that evening, where you will safely sleep as a family. And this is an impossible choice that so many parents are facing in Gaza at the moment, because despite the scaled up humanitarian response, it is just not enough. It's imperative that the ceasefire is upheld, that children, all civilians, are protected, and that the aid necessary to pull families like Nesrine from this misery comes into the Gaza Strip at the needed scale.
UNICEF say that more than 2 million Palestinians face the same challenges as Nesrine and her family.
It's a massive story, but frankly, we don't hear enough from any Palestinians themselves. Well, someone who is challenging this is our guest today. So Alaa Shahada is an actor and comedian. He's also the co-founder of the Palestinian Comedy Collective. A new documentary shows them crossing checkpoints and borders to perform in theatres across the region before the genocide began.
Building anything sustainable in Palestine is really hard.
So the line is,
I wanted to take on that challenge, to make a stand-up comedy scene in Palestine.
Come here. One last hug. You do your trousers up as well.
Yeah.
I love you. You're amazing.
You're very, very funny.
They also started to get more notice internationally and came to London for a series of gigs starting on the 7th of October, 2023. As the conflict escalated back home, the group found themselves stranded. Alaa, welcome to Pod Save the UK.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What's your sort of initial reaction to hearing about this board of peace that's being set up by Trump?
It's a realization of our position as a Palestinians. And this position is really clear now outside to the world. At the end of the day, you have no control over your future. You have no control over your children's dreams and futures. Unfortunately, I'm lucky Palestinian who's here in the UK who can perform and go all over the world. Like millions of Palestinian guys who is dreaming, who are creative and smart people, who cannot leave the homeland because of the situation. It's painful for me here. It's painful for my people back home. Everyone isn't there in an open air prison. And the only thing that we can do is support, and for myself is to tell the story, to tell the story of my people. I got the privilege to be a performer and on a stage, and I'm trying to use this as much as I can to tell my story and the story of my people back home.
Some listeners might be hearing you speak, hearing Tess Ingram speak, and think, but why comedy? You know, there's so much tragedy and hardship. Why do you use comedy in the way that you're using it? Why did you set it up, this Palestine Comedy Club?
Why comedy? It's the most question.
It's what my parents always ask me every time I go home. Why comedy?
Like, why comedy? Why comedy? Like, imagine, why don't we flip it upside down and say, why tragedy? You know, why tragedy? Why tears? And why, you know, why sad stories? Comedy opened the doors for us to say and tell and share stories that we cannot share in a form, in any other form of arts. It's a relatable language. It's an international relatable language for every human being all over the world. And telling the people about who we are as engineers, doctors, children, lovers, teachers. So it's a way to connect with the people. And the main big reason, because comedy is a big part of our culture. And that's what is not here. Comedy is like when I call my mom, like last night the army was in my town and she's laughing, you know what I mean? Like she's making fun of my father and my other brother. So I grow up with comedy. And every conversation in Palestine, if you go to a supermarket, it ends with a joke. It ends with a laughter. It ends with a smile. Even it's a hard, tough situation. And I find it myself is something really interesting because I feel it naturally is a way of surviving.
The documentary is amazing. And I will also say one of my immediate take-homes from the documentary was you have inherited your sense of humour from your mother directly. Your mother is a real star of the movie.
She is.
And you guys have got the same, exact same, like, mischief in your eyes. Because there's a talking head where you two are sat together and whatever that same, like, impulse to fuck around is. You don't realise that there's a genetic component until you see it right in front of you, right? It's amazing.
It's my mother, because she cannot tell the story normally. She got by nature the sit-up of what we learn. Yeah. Sitting up the joke, a punchline, a story, a building. She got it by her nature. And I'm looking at her while she's telling a story to my family or to the neighbours. Shit, this is a master class. You know what I mean? Like, wow. And I try to take notes, like, Mom, please tell that story, like, in my shows. Can I see your way? And like,
the thing that is so amazing about it, because it gives you an insight into the day-to-day life of being a Palestinian, which I obviously have no way of relating to. However, I have done comedy tours before. I travel around and, you know, I don't think about the way that I have to move around. But obviously for you guys to do a comedy tour, you're navigating travel restrictions and checkpoints. And there's a great, we've actually got a clip from the documentary just to look at how you got around some of those challenges.
Just waiting. And when I saw them, with this silly ass. We know how to laugh, even in this situation.
Woo! Yo, yo, yo!
The first comedian who got on the bus just said the phrase, shit on them. It's quite a tense scene where, you know, they're trying to see, you know, what's going to happen. You guys are at a checkpoint and then this, you know, bag of goofballs appears. And what, you've all wearing bucket hats.
Beautiful. The international land is a bucket hat.
Where did you buy those fucking hats?
Let me explain you that, because on the checkpoint, these hats are for the workers who works inside. So they buy them to protect them from the sun. We looked at them and it's like, they're not just for this construction work. They can be cool.
They can be.
Can we have five, please? Because we needed to look, we're not from the West Bank, from Jenin. So that's why I wanted to wear shorts, sunglasses, as a tourist coming to Haifa or going to Jerusalem.
So your new show, The Horse of Jenin, is a look, really, at your upbringing. What's it like performing that so close personal show to UK audiences?
It's an incredible show. I saw it in Edinburgh last year. It's so funny. And just as a show, it has so many different types of comedy. It's very verbal, but then at points there's kind of physical and clowning elements to it. And it's a really extraordinary bit of work. Like, it's very special.
It is special also for me on a personal level, because mainly I'm telling my personal story since being a child, including seeing the statue of a horse that was built in Jenin in 2003. And 20 years later, 2 years ago, the army with a D9 bulldozer, they ripped out the horse from the roundabout. It's a very hard image to see as someone who's been living in Jenin and seeing that horse every day and meeting everyone under that horse.
Yeah.
Because it's not just a statue of a horse, because the statue itself was built from the demolished, destroyed houses, ambulances and cars. And it became a meeting point to everyone in Jenin. And the moment that they took it, it was surprising and shocking and painful to everyone in Jenin at the same time. Like, why a statue of a horse? Like, why do you take it? Even it was not smashed. Mm. It was ripped out of the roundabout. Well, that's why I... in the show, what happened to the horse? Will it be in a part of a prisoner's exchange in the future? Like, have they asked about the stories, the secrets that happened under that horse? What I personally did there.
Yeah. So,
so it has a big sensitive memory, not just for me, for every Palestinian in Jenin. And performing it here in the UK with these responses that I have every night, it just feels amazing and great that the story is there. I can see it in people's hearts and chests and imaginations. It allows them to see new stories about Palestinians. And I'm happy about the success of this show. And at the same time, the reality hits where the situation on the ground that not just the horse, 25,000 people from Jenin camp are not living in the camp anymore, and most of their houses are destroyed and living outside of the city in a very bad situation. But at the same time, that's what I can do as a theater maker, as an artist, is to tell the story of my story and the story of my people. You know, have a conversation from a human to a human without any kind of, you know, judging you or having an image about what a Palestinian should look like and act like. Because sometimes people come and they're confused. Like, is it okay to laugh? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is it because, you know what I mean? Because they have one image about the Palestinians, you know what I mean? And someone is coming to bullshit, being open and vulnerable about everything. That's kind of something unexpected from the audiences. And that's what I'm trying to do.
You're away from home at the moment. You were away from home when the latest phase of this conflict happened, which must be, I can't imagine how difficult that is. What gives you hope at the moment in these kind of dark times?
Well, first and main thing, I cannot give up. Yeah. I need to keep moving. That is the main thing in my head, in my heart. Mm-hmm. I try to ignore everything around and just keep moving because I'm aware at least this keeps me alive.
Yeah.
At least this keeps me creative. At least this keeps me and my people seen. At least this is a type of therapy for me. Sounded easily to say that. But it's not.
Yeah.
As I told you, you go back home and then you look at these news and you call your family and your friends and you hear them. You hear the stories. You hear their voice.
Mm.
It's painful. It's painful. It's, my friends all are very creative and great people and smart and they can do a lot in their lives and their futures and their dreams. And why? Why literally simply cannot do that? We're here. You have whole possibilities to go and develop yourself, your career, your future, your dream, whatever you want to do. You have the chance, the space to decide and do it. We're back home. My people, my friends, smart, talented people are under the control. They cannot decide about their careers. They cannot decide about their hobbies, their love, their creations, their mind, their hopes, their dreams. They cannot decide about that. And that's what do we mean about freedom. Like, that's why we all the time say we need to end this occupation.
Especially when you know that so much of the Palestinian population are kids, young. Yeah. It's a very young population. And just that, you know, the picture you portrayed there of just, you cannot reach your potential. Your card is marked. Your choices are limited. I can't imagine doing a show about it is easy.
The show is extraordinary. I believe it's running for one more night at the Bush, but I think it's sold out. But if it does come back, I would really, really urge people to see it. But the documentary is also extraordinary. And it's on limited release in independent cinemas across the UK from the 27th of February with the support of the BFI. We will provide links to all of that in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you guys. Thank you for hosting me.
So Nish, I cannot let us leave without having a chat about the biggest political story of the week. It's the Beckham family feud.
Yeah.
So Brooklyn Beckham has claimed that his mum, Victoria Beckham, aka Posh Spice, upstaged his wife at their wedding. And get this, she refused to help displaced dogs affected by the LA wildfires. How will she ever come back from this?
Well, we also did not help the dogs in LA.
No.
We didn't. We're as bad. Listen, it's very sad for every family. It's very weird that like a family's business is like all across the internet.
Yeah.
Everything about it is deeply strange.
And with the news being what it is, do you not believe that this is the entertainment we all really need? The distraction we need? They're doing a national service, international service. If you're watching Brooklyn Beckham, I hate to break it to you, you are in a big South Asian family. yeah, essentially is what's happened to you.
Oh man.
If you were in LA, reach out to Kumail Nanjiani. He can help you. Okay? Just letting I just think he needs help understanding all of this.
I am fascinated to know what help you think Kumail is going to be able to provide Brooklyn Beckham.
The mother-in-law that wants to make it all about her.
Oh, it's, listen, it's
family,
South
duty,
Asian as
disrespect.
Fuck. Yeah.
Come on. Call me Brooklyn. I can help you. That's it. Thank you for listening to Pod Save the UK. Don't forget to follow at Pod Save the UK on Instagram, TikTok, X and Blue Sky.
Pod Save the UK is a reduced listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to lead producer May Robson and digital producer Jacob Liebenberg.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
Our engineer is Jeep Vasani and our social media producer is Leonore Schick.
The executive producers are Kate Fitzsimons and Katie Long, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you missed some of your favorite Crooked Pods this week, don't worry. You can now catch up on the week's best moments on MS Now on Saturday nights. MS Now is streaming an episode of highlights from your favorite Crooked Pods, packing as much analysis, funny moments, and 100% correct opinions into 40 minutes as humanly possible. Crooked on MS Now airs every Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific.